And this is happening at a faster and faster rate, that people, even if they find some other job, that automation is not eliminating all jobs, but it took your job. That is a crisis. We need basic income to smooth out this increasingly precarious labor market.
The Rational View is a weekly series hosted by me, Dr. Alan Scott, providing a rational, evidence-based perspective on important societal issues.
Produced by Soapbox Media.
The world needs evidence-based public policy now more than ever. Making the right decisions should not be partisan politics. Please help spread The Rational View by going to patron.podbean.com/TheRationalView. Together, we can make a better future.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Rational View. In this episode, I'm discussing the economic impacts of the artificial intelligence revolution and whether or not it's time for universal basic income. Artificial intelligence will take over our jobs, increase productivity per remaining worker to compensate. We're bound for a situation where owners and shareholders will be able to squeeze more profits from a declining workforce, while the working class continues on the path to extinction and increasing hardship. Corporate profits need to keep increasing to pay shareholders, and corporations have been able to use the threat of offshoring jobs while having to compete with less scrupulous companies to hold wages down over the last several decades. I'm a proponent of some sort of UBI, but I recognize that the path from here to there is not obvious. I fear that if we don't find a peaceful means to distribute the increasingly concentrated wealth created by robotics and AI, that the uprising is coming. People are getting restless. We see this in our discussions, how easy it is to isolate people and to make them angry. The hatred is growing. People's conditions are getting worse. Despite being significantly more productive than our parents' generation, we have less real wealth, less purchasing power, less free time, less leisure. AI and robotics were supposed to free us from this grind, make life easier. Instead, we've come to compete with robots in a dwindling job market to make ends meet. It doesn't have to be this way. Is there an equitable and peaceful path to more widely share the benefits of automation? Or are we rushing headlong into upheaval? Please, if you enjoy what you're hearing, press like on your podcast app. Leave a review if you have the time. I'd really appreciate it. And thank you so much for listening. Dr. Carl Witterquist has a PhD in economics from the City University of New York. For several years, Witterquist pursued both music and economics. He played in several indie bands in New York in the 1990s. He was a Hoover Fellow at the Université Catholique de Louvain. Witterquist received a second doctorate in political theory at the University of Oxford, and then worked as a fellow at the Murphy Institute at Tulane University and as a visiting professor at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. Since 2009, he's been an associate professor at Georgetown University, Qatar. Witterquist has been the co-chair of the Basic Income Earth Network since 2008. Dr. Witterquist, welcome to The Rational View.
Hi, I was promoted to a full professor about 5 or 6 years ago.
So, congratulations.
From that, it's accurate.
So just to get a feel for who you are and what you do, could you tell us a little bit about your background and your interest? I mean, it was very interesting to learn that you were a performing musician, in fact.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town called Cassopolis, Michigan. I learned about basic income when I was 15 from a documentary show on television. It was called Guaranteed Income or Negative Income Tax then. The differences are technical. I'm interested in music and writing. And I actually, I was in bands in high school and college. And then when I got to grad school, I happened to see an ad for a band that was looking for a bass player. And I'm in New York for the first time. And like, well, this looks like a fun thing to do while I'm in grad school. So I pursued both actually nice. Pretty seriously throughout the 1990s. The band actually, Remember Alice, has like over 80 songs up on Spotify that are getting listened to still.
That's very neat. So the reason I brought you on The Rational View is, you know, I've been focusing a little bit on artificial intelligence and how that is progressing. And, you know, I'm a student of history. I've seen how badly it seems that we've botched the automation revolution. You know, the average person in North America hasn't benefited from the increases of productivity that automation has given us. And I can see that, you know, this is coming for us, that, you know, the top 1% have significantly improved their wealth and living conditions. You know, what is coming for us when AI becomes more prevalent and starts taking more jobs away from the middle class?
This worry about AI is, this worry about the future of AI has brought a lot of people to the basic income movement. However, I don't think we should focus too much about the future. We should focus about the here and now, and AI is already involved in that, and other forms of automation have been involved in that really for hundreds of years. The fear that automation will replace all human labor it sounds crazy. It's actually not crazy. It really could happen, but there's no assurance that it's going to happen tomorrow or 5 years from now or 50 years from now. It's really hard to predict these things. And if you think it can't happen, it happened to the horse. It happened to every beast of burden. That there were millions of horses with jobs in 1900, and all of them were unemployed by 1920, except for a few hansom cabs and some police horses, and very rare uses, actually uses of horses for things other than recreation. So it conceivably mm-hmm. could happen. Yeah, humans are different than horses, but of course horses are different than rocks, and we replaced rocks with other kinds of tool building things, and it could happen. But the worry that it will happen, I think, could turn more people off than on, because it sounds crazy, and then it gives people an automatic ammunition to say, okay, well, we'll wait for that to happen. Yeah, when every single job is gone because of automation, then we'll have basic income. It tells people to put it off until way in the future. And then there's another problem with this looking to this future where there are no jobs that people worry about, is I don't think automation looks like automation. You know how they say drowning doesn't look like drowning? Well, what people expect when they expect automation replacing jobs is lower employment, higher unemployment, lower employment, higher unemployment, ever, ever increasing unemployment. But that's, sure. I don't think that's how it would play out, because when people lose their jobs, they don't just sit unemployed, they try to get jobs. So what you see is people going to the bottom of the labor market. You see increasing inequality. You see lower wages and more precarious employment for people at the bottom, but you don't necessarily see increasing unemployment rates. And that's what we've been seeing. That's what we're seeing, not just now. We've been seeing that for 40 or 50 years. So I think you've got to look at, when you talk about automation, you've got to be looking at that this has been going on, this idea that you've got a good skilled job and then somebody automates it away and you go to the bottom of the labor market. That's been happening for hundreds of years. That's what the Luddite movement was about over 200 years ago, mostly in Britain. Skilled textile workers were being replaced by machines. And they weren't against the machines. They were against the fact that they'd spent their whole lives building up these skills, getting these what was a good middle-class job for the late 17, early 1800s, and all that was being taken away, and they were asked to become a factory worker working like 12 hours a day for a lot less pay. That's what they were against, was taking their livelihoods away. And this kind of stuff happens all the time. And very often, in the end, if you go far enough, there end up being more and better jobs for everyone. By the late 1800s, there were more and better jobs for everyone than there were in the beginning of the 1800s due to things like automation. However, that means, okay, your grandchildren might have more and better jobs, or maybe your children, but very often you don't recover. Even if your children recover, if they go through periods of economic trauma and poverty and destitution when they're young, that can scar them for life in a way that's costly to them and costly for society. So this churning of the labor market that AI is causing, that's a big problem already. That's why we need basic income now. So when your job is automated away, some will be, even if more and better jobs come along, somebody's job is going to be automated away, that you get a soft landing. You get a cushion of landing on your basic income. You can look for another job. You can improve your skills. You can decide what to do next instead of the system we have, which is so cruel. You built up all your skills. You've been doing what they tell you to do. Then they say your skills aren't needed anymore. And you're worthless, and you got to get any job you can, whether you're a checkout at Walmart before that's automated, or you're whatever the lowest job you can find, and throwing people down into a lot of fear and misery when we don't have to do that. We've had a really poor safety net for the last 50 years. As you were mentioning, a lot of benefits have gone to the 1%. In the last 40 or 50 years, in 40 years, our economy has doubled in size. And almost all of those benefits have gone to the top 1% or 2%. The rest of us are not materially any better off. We're working just as hard and struggling just as much to pay our rent as we were, or more, as we were 40 years ago. And when all this automation has happened and all of us have worked and helped to contribute to this, and most of us haven't got a share, that's one of the reasons you need basic income now, because you haven't got a share in the gains of this economy of the last 40 or 50 years.
So, you know, I've looked at the data as well over the last, you know, since the 70s, you know, things have diverged. Productivity and wages, real wages in a real sense, have diverged since the 70s. Some people would say, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. Some people would say, sure, the top 1% have benefited, but really what we're doing is we're bringing, you know, globalization is bringing the abject poor around the world out of poverty. And, you know, the current economic system is working to be a global net benefit. And so maybe our livelihoods have decreased a little bit from their opulent luxury of the 70s, but overall there's a net benefit to this system. How would you respond?
Well, to bring the global poor up to the level of the American middle class, it would be a great thing. And to the extent that it is in a minor way happening, it is a great thing. But that really has very little to do with the middle class and the lower class in the U.S. stagnating to the benefit of the top 1%. The top 1% has benefited enormously from the economy in the last 50 years, and the rest of us haven't. It's not that we've just been sharing with the rest of the world. I wish we were doing more of that, but we should be doing more of that at the expense of the top 1%. And these touted benefits of the global poor are not as good as they've often been portrayed. Most of that rise was in China. Was in China between the 80s and the teens, when China had this amazing rise, because China accounts for a huge percentage of the world's population. And in the 70s, during the Cultural Revolution, China was desperately poor. And China did not deliver all of that by having global free markets. They did that with a lot of infrastructure spending, an economy that was guided, sometimes misguided, by a government that's not very responsive to its people. But it wasn't the free market that did it either. It was a few good moves. Some of the moves that the Chinese government made for a while were actually good moves. A lot of people around the world are also stagnating in South America, in Central America, in parts of Africa. There's a lot of economic stagnation. Just for an example, South Africa has not recovered from the enormous unemployment that hit there in the post-apartheid era. And people in South Africa are just stagnating. There's an enormous crime that comes from this desperation. So the idea that the globalization is solving everybody's problem, it's not going to do that unless we really have an active solution like basic income.
So many would argue that taking, you know, the hard-earned money away from people who have worked for it and distributing it to people who have not earned this money is a moral wrong. I've looked at some of your lectures, and you have an interesting counter-argument. You actually advocate for UBI as a moral imperative. What's your position on that argument?
The big money in a capitalist economy is not in doing stuff. The big money is in owning stuff. The money goes to the owners. If you want to do anything, if you want to start a business, you've got to get banks or other investors to put their money into it. Entrepreneurs, to the extent that they get rich, and some of them do get very rich, they get rich by enriching other owners. And we have a saying in economics that comes from Thomas Piketty: the entrepreneur eventually becomes a rentier. You start a company, you have some big innovative ideas, and you make a lot of money off that. Then you invest that, or it remains in your company, which is no longer entrepreneurial, and you just get returns and returns and returns. And what your returns on are from ownership. So, for example, in Steve Jobs' life, I mean, Steve Jobs is the kind of guy you would call an entrepreneur. He made $8 billion. Well, over that same period, the heir to the L'Oreal fortune also made $8 billion. She started with a lot more. And what did she do? She owned stuff. Now, Steve Jobs' fortune, which is owned by people who do not work at Apple Computers, it's owned by his family, it's something like doubled in size since his death because they're rentiers. That's where the money in the economy is in being a rentier. And a lot of the hard work that people do is in order to try to become a rentier. A lot of the stuff that people do on Wall Street, that do in banks, is not about greasing the wheels of the economy. It's about trying to get the gains. What rentiers have done is they own virtually all the resources of the earth. Everything that's not owned by governments are owned by private rentiers, and they sell it back to the rest of us. They didn't create the resources. They might have improved them. They might have improved the resources. But when they own everything, that means all of us have to go and enrich the already rich in order to get our jobs, in order to do things. I mean, you have to serve people who already own, or there's no money. There's absolutely no money in serving the homeless and the destitute because they don't have any money to spend on you. If you want to say, hey, I've got a great idea that's going to end homelessness, what do? You go to rich people and you start trying to raise money, which really demonstrates that our economy is focused on rewarding those who already have. And they have because they own the resources, but they've taken the resources from the common pool that don't belong to anybody, that could be of anybody's use. And they say, these are ours. You can't have them unless you do stuff for us. That's not consistent with freedom. It's not consistent with equal protection of the laws. If you have more of the resources of the earth than somebody else, you should be paying them. That's what basic income is. It is the farthest thing from something for nothing. It is something for something. It is cash and services from those who own stuff to the people who do not own stuff, or who otherwise, without the basic income, would not own stuff. It is your compensation for the fact that other people control more of the earth than you do.
It's kind of like a Magna Carta for the economy.
Yeah. And also the idea that basic income, people want to portray basic income as bad for workers. And that is just the biggest lie. The worst thing in the world you can do for a worker is to put them in a position where they have no other choice to take whatever jobs are available. That is a recipe for low wages, poor working conditions, dead-end jobs, sexual harassment on the job, things that are really horrible for workers. It might be good for work in getting people to work more and more hours for lower and lower pay. But that's not good for workers. That's good for people who like to pay low wages. It's not even good for people who like to pay high wages. Employers who like to pay high wages are forced by the market to treat workers the way everybody else does. That's right. Go on.
Understanding that, you know, okay, so UBI is recognized as a moral good, you know, so is a chicken in every pot, so is handing out a bar of gold to everyone. A reasonable objection to UBI goes into the feasibility or sustainability of it. Giving out free money is going to create inflation. It's going to raise the amount one needs to give out to stay at the poverty line, and it's always going to be unsustainable. I've heard this argument again and again. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've done calculations that the net cost of a basic income in the United States that would be just about at the poverty line would be about 2.95% of GDP. That's not a huge amount. It was about a quarter of what we're already spending on transfer payments. It is lower than the cost of the Defense Department in the United States. Obviously, defense spending is a lot more reasonable in Canada. But the cost would be similar in Canada, because what you have to take into account when you look at the cost of basic income is that you're simultaneously giving people money, but you're also taxing it back from them. So you got to look at the net redistributive effect. Those people who pay more in taxes than they receive in basic income, how much more are they paying on net when you subtract that? And those who are receiving more in basic income than they're paying in taxes, how much are they receiving on net? And those two figures, if it's a balanced budget, are going to be about the same. It doesn't necessarily have to be a balanced budget. But now that 2.95% of GDP in new spending, that is inflationary pressure. However, all government spending creates inflationary pressure. Basic income is not special spending. The government buys an aircraft carrier, that's inflationary spending. The government gives a big handout to the banks like it loves to do, or to other campaign contributors. All of that creates inflationary spending, pressure, just like basic income. And we counteract inflationary pressure with two things, with taxes and the sale of bonds. We use the sale of bonds way too much. We should be using taxes more, and we should use judiciously chosen taxes, the ones that are going to most cut into the most wasteful spending and investments of wealthy people. Those will have the most counterinflationary effects. And 2.95% increase in GDP, 2.95% of GDP increase in spending is an inflationary pressure that we can easily counteract.
That doesn't seem like a big number. I mean, I look at, you know, to get, you know, in the U.S., you know, 350 million people up to the poverty line, to put that much money, it's a lot more. So you're talking about a net cost of GDP minus additional taxation. So you're also assuming in that number a lot of additional taxation. Is that correct?
You have to look at it. You've got to give people money, and then you've got to raise taxes. So you say you've got taxes. You say your tax rate is 50% of income. So just to make the math easy, and you give people $10,000 a year, which is lower than I would like, but it makes the math easy. That means if you're making zero, you're making zero on a job or something, you're getting $10,000 a year and you're not paying any taxes. But if you make $10,000, you're still getting your $10,000 in basic income, and you're paying $5,000 in taxes. So on net, your net benefit is $5,000. Your net benefit is not the full $10,000. So just even a person with a very low income is still not getting the full $10,000 benefit when you take their taxes into account. And it has to work this way, or it would be rampant inflation. But if you make it this way, you can get one that is high enough to eliminate poverty. The one I researched too, the one that was right at the poverty line is not really the one that I most prefer. That would cost 2.95% of the GDP. A higher one that was more like 160% of the poverty line, taking into account that the poverty line doesn't measure very well. That one costs more like 10% of GDP. That's a lot more ambitious. A good way would be start with a small one and ratchet it up and see if there are negative effects. But we have done this before. We have raised spending by more than 10% of GDP and taken huge numbers of workers out of the labor market and still not had rampant inflation. We did this in World War II. We did this again in Korea. We took huge numbers of people out of the labor market and still were able to produce the things that we needed. And our consumption spending actually went up during World War II. The consumption of the working and middle class actually went up.
So, you know, you can do this through taxation. You raise the taxation, keep the net impact reasonably manageable. Mm-hmm. So the next objection is, won't all the rich people and companies leave if we put taxes back to high levels? They're all going to be in Panama. Nobody's going to be registering in the U.S. and Canada if we implement this high taxation regime. You know, they can't compete globally. Isn't that the result of this process? There's a lot we can do.
If we really want to, there's a lot we can do to fight tax havens. A lot of the reason we have tax havens is because we allow them because wealthy people are so influential that we make laws that suit them, and they want to have these tax havens and have all that allowed. This can be reversed if we. One of the most important things we need to do, in order to do like anything else, especially in the United States, but I think to some extent in places like Canada and Britain as well, and a lot of countries, is get the power of money out of politics. We have in the United States a system of legalized bribery, where they call it. They say money is speech. Money given to candidates is not speech. It is bribery. And the wealthy control our laws. It's not just tax havens, and it's not just that we tax them low. Well, though we do tax the wealthy very low, but we also tax the wealthy very, very low, and then we buy things from the super wealthy that the average citizen doesn't want, such as pennies. In the United States, we're still making pennies, even though they buy one-tenth as much as they did when I was a kid, and we didn't really need pennies when I was a kid either. And nobody was saying back when I was a kid, we need to have a one-tenth of a cent piece. Nobody wanted that. Now we have it because the company that makes the pennies spreads the campaign contributions throughout both parties in Congress, and whatever else laws they make sure we're still making the pennies. They do that with all sorts of things, with giveaways to the banks, with giveaways. You take away these giveaways. With a lot of our defense spending isn't even stuff that the Pentagon wants. It's something that Boeing or the other defense contractors want the government to buy. It's some crap. So you take this away, that frees up a lot of money for basic income. But another thing you can do to avoid these tax havens is tax the things that can't move. Our banking system is completely dependent on the Federal Reserve Board to insulate it from risk. Yet, we don't charge them that. It's for profit for the private banks, and then it's not for profit at the central bank. If we would charge the private banks the actual
socialism
value
for the rich.
The most democratic branch of the U.S. government is the Federal Reserve. It is government of the bankers, by the bankers, and for the bankers at the expense of everybody else. If we started charging them market rates, we charge a market rate for the broadcast spectrum, which they give away for free, and then the cell phone companies and the broadcast companies sell it back to us at a huge premium. If we charge rent on that, that would be a lot of money. Another thing is the value of land. Land value is way under tax in the U.S. Natural resource value, which things that pollute, the cost of pollution, All of those things you could tax, and they really can't, either they can't move or you actually want them to go away anyway. If you tax the smokestacks, well, actually, we wanted you to close some of those smokestacks anyway. And you can't move that gold mine. You can't move that oil well. Tax that. Norway taxes oil that it's drilled more than double what we charge for drilling in Alaska. And Norway still finds plenty of oil companies that want to go and drill that oil up for them.
It's true. So I liked, I was listening to one of your lectures, and you made the analogy to between homelessness and what we do in the prison systems, looking at the morality of, forcing people to struggle for, food and homes, versus, people that have created crimes are being housed and fed. Mm-hmm. I think that was a really good analogy that you made.
Yeah. One of the things I point out in the book that the book is Universal Basic Income for the Essential Knowledge series of MIT Press. And it is one of the things that I point out there is what we have is a mandatory participation society, where you have to participate in the market economy unless you're independently wealthy. Which is kind of strange, because the very most privileged people, the people that everything works for, the people that get things done for them, they actually do not have to contribute any labor to this economy whatsoever. They might do it. A lot of rich people have jobs. A lot of rich people work hard, but they can simply live off their assets. The returns on their assets, they can be a rentier. And you can do that for generation after generation after generation if your family chooses to, and some have. But for them, it's voluntary participation. And for the rest of us, it is mandatory participation, which what I mean by that is you will be penalized. We've taken all of the resources and say the government owns a bit. Most of it is in private hands. You got to go to some private person with resources, work for them, or you will eventually be homeless and on the street. 98-99% of us, at least before we are eligible for Social Security, if we're not on disability, the 99% of us are not wealthy enough that we could stop working. If we stop working long enough, we will eventually lose our home. We will be on the street. We will be begging. That is essentially the punishment for not working. The punishment for not working is very severe. It is. Exposure to the elements, chance of malnutrition or worse, eating out of a dumpster, it's begging on the streets and things like that. That is a penalty. That is a punishment. And we walk by homeless people every day, and this is supposed to motivate us to keep working. And that is in some ways a worse penalty than what we do to actual criminals. Actual criminals, we take them off the streets, but we put them in a safe place hopefully safe. It should be a lot safe. Prison should be a lot safer than they are. But we put them in a place where they're not exposed to the elements. We feed them meals that are going to keep them alive. We give them at least some medical care while they're in prison. And we don't do this for the homeless. So we all of us face in some ways, refusing to work for the market economy is a worse penalty than committing an actual crime. And when you do this, when you have such a severe penalty for people who don't work, what you're doing is creating an enormous advantage for employers who like to pay low wages and offer poor working conditions and sexually harass people on the job, as I've mentioned. That's the situation we're all in. We have a basic income. It reverses that incentive problem. Then the employer suddenly has an incentive. If I want somebody to work for me, I've got to give them a good job. I've got to give them advancement opportunities. I've got to give them good pay, good working conditions. I can't sexually harass them on the job, at least not as much as they used to. You're giving all sorts of leverage to people to command higher wages and better working conditions. And we've seen that in some of the stuff we talked about before, how between the 30s and the 70s, the lower class and the middle class were keeping up with the growth of the economy. since about the mid-70s, the lower and middle class has stagnated, and almost all the gains have gone to the top 1% or 2%. Part of that is because in that period, we gutted the welfare system and we gutted the unions, so workers have less leverage. Basic income gives that leverage back and makes that leverage better than ever, so we can all command better jobs.
So we agree that some form of UBI is needed to stave off suffering and the acceleration of suffering that's going to happen in our current system with the rise of automation and AI. How do we get from here to there? Our political system favors the rich. It favors the people with money to put in the pockets of politicians. What needs to happen to fix the problem?
Well, that is kind of getting out of the area, what I do, into the area of what the basic income activists do. When I started, what are my strengths? My strengths are in research and writing. I will go and support the activists, but I'm not going to tell the activists what to do. But also, I wanted to work on the biggest problem in the world. And growing up in the post-civil rights era, I thought the biggest remaining problem in the world was poverty. And then the solution really isn't that hard. The ethics of poverty became my thing. But since then, I've realized there's a lot of other blocks in the way. As I've talked about, the legalized bribery we call our campaign contribution system, that's creating huge blocks. There's also, in just about any society that's ever existed, privileged people have controlled the dialogue. And so you hear the perspective of the wealthy. So you hear that, poor people who don't work are bad. Nobody says employers that pay low wages are the bad ones, and poor people who don't work are having really the rational response to somebody who pays crappy wages. Nobody says that. The dialogue is shifting. One, we've got to do things to shift that dialogue, that takes a lot of activism of the people. We need to take back the power of our government from the wealthiest people. The countries that have done this the best are places like Finland, Norway, Iceland, a few other places. Those are the most democratic governments in the world, where the government is most responsive to the desires of the people. And those are also the governments with the most social support for people who need it, the most humane societies. Hmm.
So you're not an activist. You've got a PhD in economics, PhD in politics. Is it political theory?
Political theory, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's essentially political philosophy taught in a political science department.
Yeah. You recognize the role of activism to get there. And effectively what we need is to change the system where money gives access to power. And this is a democratic push more than anything. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of activist groups pushing for basic income in the United States and in Canada and a lot of other places. In the United States, we have Income Movement, which organizes marches and organizes conferences and is doing lobbying work. We've got other groups that are doing this. When those groups want me to help out, I will go, I will give my talk and stuff like that. But I'm not going to tell them what strategy to do. I've got to defer to them. They're the experts on strategy. I might be an expert on how do we cost this thing out? How do we make a philosophical argument? How do we understand how it works in the political system? But they're the experts on this activism stuff. The researchers and the activists have to respect each other in these places. When researchers try to come in and control everything, they often send things wrong, you know?
So, I mean, some people would say that, okay, we're going to throw this basic income in. So now all the lazy poor people aren't going to work anymore and productivity is going to go down and then inflation is going to go up anyways. I think there have been some actual tests of pilots of basic income that have tested this hypothesis. What What data do we have on what's going to happen if we implement UPI?
Well, there have been a lot of pilot projects in the United States. There was two in Canada, two major ones in Canada, both of which were canceled before they were finished. One eventually was finished 30 years later. The other one, there's a lawsuit on the one, you probably know about this one in Ontario, where there was a major basic income study involving thousands of people. And they cut it off. It was supposed to last for 3 years. They cut it off for a year. And there's now a major lawsuit saying you promised these people 3 years. If they participated in this program, they held up their end of the bargain. They participated. So that was all. There's been these experiments. And there's been one in Namibia. There's been a couple in India. There's a huge one going on in Kenya. And there've been a few in Europe. Problem with these is what they can tell you about basic income is very limited. They're always targeted. Basic income is not targeted. So it can tell you how does basic income, how would a basic income affect this little group in isolation? But basic income doesn't affect people in isolation. It affects people all at once. And those interactive effects between person and person and between person and business are really important. So none of these experiments are going to say, how would wages go up? If people work, if you give people a substantial basic income and they work less, are wages and working conditions going to go up? How much? None of these studies can answer that question. So some of the most important things we want to know, they can't answer. Then a lot of what they do find is determined by targeting. If you give a very low basic income to people who are working less than full time, you will almost always see that they work more. In Kenya, where they have to give a very low basic income, or else they'd be making the people in this village way richer than the people in the next village over, and you can't do that. So they give a very low basic income to people who are not working very much, and you find they work more. We've done that with a lot of these. Pilot projects in the U.S. have been $500 a month. That's not enough to live on. And they've been giving it mostly to people who are not able to work very much. And you find you get that little cushion and they work more, because a lot of the reason people don't work is they can't afford to. You got to get the right clothes to wear to go to work. That costs money. You got to get on a bus. That costs money and time. A lot of jobs, you need a car. A lot of people can't afford a car until they get the job. It's a big chicken and egg thing. And these basic incomes for those groups will cause them to work more. However, studies that give a higher basic income, something like around the poverty line, and you give it to people who are already working full time, then what you'll find is they will work a little bit less. But none of the studies have shown them working a lot less. They've shown them taking the time to find the right job. Like if they lose their job, people without basic income will often very quickly take whatever jobs available. People who have a basic income or the negative income tax, basic income's cousin, will take their time to find the right job. And that's the kind of thing that is good for matching the right skills with the right job, but it's also good for getting the workers the kind of leverage that I've been talking about throughout this interview. None of them, and so some of them some of the studies have shown a decline in the number of hours that the poor work. But if you think the poor are working, the poor are working the right amount of, all the poor should be working 2,000 hours a year or more, basic income is probably not the program for you. But you've got to think the poor are working too hard. Most of us are working too hard. We're automating the economy. We could all be working half as much as we did in the 1970s and consuming the same. Instead, we're working just as hard or harder and consuming as a little, if anything, more, a lot of us. A decline in the number of hours people work from 2,000 hours a year to 1,800 or 1,600 a year is not a bad thing at all. That's really good for our health and for the overall happiness of our society.
Yes, but I don't think it's going to happen because, you know, we need this continuous growth to keep the shareholders happy. And what happens if their value starts to decrease? If we stop working so hard, the GDP growth will slow, right? Our productivity is higher. If we have the whole economic model we have is built on continual growth rather than plateauing. If we plateau at a continuous GDP, as our productivity goes up, we lower our working hours to keep the same level of productivity, then the economic model falls apart.
Well, not necessarily. Very often, the productivity gains exceed the losses from the number of hours worked. I just was looking at a map of the number of hours of work across European countries, the average number of hours worked per year across European countries. And one of the highest ones was Russia, which is not a terribly rich country. Another one was someplace in the Balkans, over 2,000 hours a year. Worked in these countries. Whereas you look at the wealthiest countries, the countries with the highest GDP, Norway, Iceland, the Netherlands, Germany, you have an average work hours that are more around 1,600 hours a year, or even less than that. I think somewhere like at 1,300. So we do not need obsessive work to keep growing. And too much focus on growth is counterproductive. Economic growth is not all there is. My grandfather was a farmer. He was born in 1895 on a farm in Indiana. And he eventually left farming because he hated the industrialization that farming was happening, all the crap that they were telling him to put in the soil. He says, we have to reach a point where what we take out of the soil is exactly the same as what we put back to the soil. That's what my grandfather, the farmer, said. And of course, that is exactly right. If our growth is coming at the expense of our environment, more and more pollution, less and less habitat, we will eventually kill ourselves. But that doesn't mean zero growth. We have to have zero growth of resource use. We got to get to the point where we have a steady state of resource uses. However, we can always find ways to use those resources better and more efficiently. And that's where future economic growth comes from. When you stop, you cut, you use less land, but you use the land you have more productively. They've really done this. A car uses a lot less steel than it did decades ago because they use it more efficiently. Sure. Things like that.
Yeah. No, that's very good, very good analysis. You've obviously thought about this quite a bit, and I appreciate your insights. We're getting towards the end of our interview here, and I've learned a lot about exactly what the benefits of UBI are. You don't think AI is any different than what's been going on in the economy for decades now already with automation. So that's interesting. I feel that it's going to accelerate if we don't do something. We're in a position where the problem is going to get much worse much faster. I think with the artificial intelligence performance that we're seeing now, it's going to be taking over a lot more. And we're in for some serious soul searching, I think. And I'm just wondering what it is going to take to motivate us to fix the problem. I don't want to see blood in the streets before this happens.
I'm not saying that can't happen. What I'm saying is we have no reason to wait for that to happen. We've got plenty of reason to have UBI now, and to say, oh, there's this thing that's gonna happen maybe someday. That just gives people the ammunition to say, well, let's wait for someday. But some of the stuff you're having, the automation that's happening now, I think it is in one way different than what was going on 200 years ago. 200 years ago, you could point to one thing being automated at a time. Okay, right around the turn of the 19th century, it was a textile. And, then it was replacing horses with railroads. It was a few things. Now there's all kinds of things happening all the time. Even if in the end there's more jobs, and right now there are more jobs in the U.S. economy than there have ever been. But Those aren't necessarily better jobs. And those aren't necessarily more secure jobs. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, a lot of people expected a lifetime job. You get in with a company, and that company's going to grow, and you're going to keep that job until you retire. That's not realistic for many people in the world today. Your job can be taken away by automation at any time. And this is happening at a faster and faster rate that people, even if they find some other job, that automation is not eliminating all jobs, but it took your job. That is a crisis for you. We need basic income to smooth out this increasingly precarious labor market. That really, and you can, this is not something I've studied, but from the people who have, that's something that really has increased over the last 40 years, is the precariousness of the economy. Read any of Guy Standing's work on the precariat, and you get stuff like that. That is his real name. His real name is Guy Standing, and he has several books on basic income and several books on precarity, the precariat. He calls people with precarious jobs the precariat.
Oh, nice. Very good. I think, you know, people are afraid of change. It's just, you know, we know this horrible system that we're stuck in, and we're worried that it's going to get worse if we try to change it. But I think in Canada, we have even more motivation to go to a UBI than in the US, because we have a public health system, and the cost of dealing with, you know, the poor health problems of the poor that don't have the access to health care, for example, that don't eat healthy because they can't afford the food, is a real cost on the taxpayer already. And you know, we're going to get a lot of payback in eliminating crime, in eliminating healthcare costs that aren't necessary. I think, you know, the economic argument for it is quite strong to actually go ahead with some sort of a stronger safety net for these precariats.
The healthcare system, moving to a Canadian style healthcare system could finance a big chunk of basic income right there, because the United States spends twice as much on healthcare as Canada does, and we're not any healthier. We're actually probably less healthy than Canadians. We do not get better care. We're much more likely to be refused care in the United States because your health insurance decided not to cover it than you are in Canada, where there might be a waiting list or something. You're gonna get the care.
That gives you better, quicker access for those that are accepted.
Yeah, but that's not why we have. We don't have the private healthcare system because wealthy people who are customers of the private healthcare system like it. Not at all. You got to go way, way high up in the very top 1% to get people that actually have had a major health crisis and actually like their healthcare company. I know like a rich person that has one of those healthcare plans, and nobody can afford it. It's like $20,000 a year or something, or more. The reason we have such expensive healthcare is because the for-profit healthcare companies, the for-profit hospitals, the for-profit insurers, the for-profit drug manufacturers, these people are all spreading those lobbyist dollars around Congress to make it impossible to create a system that the people actually want and would benefit from. Obama even admitted this when they did Obamacare, which was some effort to move towards universal health care while simultaneously giving a lot of government goodies to the for-profit healthcare industry. It was about as good as you can get given that constraint. He even said this when people talking about what we need is a single payer like Canada has. And he said, well, what about all these people who have jobs in this for-profit healthcare system? Well, it kind of admits that these are just bullshit jobs that we don't need. We wouldn't have all these accountants and advertising people in our healthcare system if we went to a Canadian style system.
That's another threat to work. If you can't have a job and get healthcare, or if you can't have a job, you don't get healthcare in the U.S. effectively.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And a lot of jobs, you get a job and still don't get health care.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it does make people, it makes people afraid to leave their jobs, of fear of losing their health care. That's probably one of the reasons that my wife and I don't retire early, is we've got good health care through our employers, and we can afford everything else. But affording health care as good as what we're getting through our employers, that would be really tough. And there's so many people in that situation. That has gotten a little better with Obamacare, but it's still a big problem.
Well, thank you for your time, Carl. I really appreciate you coming and chatting with us today about universal basic income and the arguments for that. And for spending your time, I'd be happy to send you a Rational View t-shirt if you like.
That'd be
so
great.
Much for coming and chatting with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
If you'd like to follow up with more in-depth discussions, please come find us on Facebook at The Rational View and join our discussion group. If you like what you're hearing, please consider visiting my Patreon page at patreon.podbean.com/The Rational View. Thanks for listening.